Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer Michael Beinhorn. But first, let's talk about your Facebook likes and the fact that they may drop soon. The reason why is Facebook recently changed their algorithm once again, and of course, Facebook and all the search engines, Google and Bing and everybody, Yahoo, they all rejigger their algorithms at least once a year, and actually even more than that. And one of the reasons why is they don't want anybody to be able to game the system, so to speak. The other reason why is there's usually a pretty good reason, and in this case, it's to scrub the likes. Now, why would you want to scrub the likes? This is what they call it, scrub the likes. First of all, likes don't do you much good if they're not representative of your audience. And one of the big problems is a lot of times, especially on Facebook, there are people that aren't active on Facebook or they have accounts that are basically closed. So having those likes isn't representative of the audience because a lot of that audience isn't there. There's also another piece to the puzzle here, and that's what they call memorialized accounts. And this is for people that are deceased and their families or their friends take over that account just to keep the Facebook posts alive, so to speak. So even though there's no new posts, if someone wants to go back and look at what your posts were when you were alive, that's all possible. That being said, that doesn't help you because it's not an active user. It doesn't help you if your fan isn't an active user. So this is what scrubbing likes is. But the other thing that happens with all this is the comments get scrubbed as well. So what you'll find is that all of a sudden your comments will be a whole lot less. This may not be too much of a big deal to you if you're not really looking at likes or counting them and counting comments. However, it might be important for things like record labels. Record labels are very aware of those things, and if they're considering you for a deal, sometimes if you have more likes, that's really important to them. If you have a lot of comments, that's really important to them. And of course, every time you lose one or two or 10 or however many, that's really a detriment. Now, the other thing is, some of your followers actually tend to like you better if you have more likes. And this is a documented fact. The more likes you have, the more you get. So if you find that suddenly these likes are going down instead of up, that in fact can impact future likes. As silly as that sounds, it actually does work. So anyway, look for that to happen in the near future where your Facebook likes and comments may go down. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is the five ways to charge for your services. If you're listening to this, you're a musician, you're an engineer, you're a producer, but you're probably working on your own. You're an independent contractor. And what that means is you have to get paid. And there are five ways to actually work in this business and get paid. Let's look at them and let's look at some of the advantages and disadvantages. The first one is you can charge a flat project fee. So in other words, if someone hires you to plan an album, to engineer an album, to produce an album, to work on an album, whatever the case may be, they might say, I will give you $500 for the whole album. I'll give you $1,000. They'll give you $5,000, whatever the amount is. What they're expecting is for you to work on that album for that amount of money until the album is finished. Now, one of the big problems with this is there's usually no hard and cold end date, unless there's some sort of delivery date that has to go to a label, for instance. That's different, but even that can be changed. So what ends up happening is the artist can come in at any time and say, well, you know, let's do two more songs because I'm not happy with a couple of songs. Let's do several more versions. You know, I'd like to do a reggae version of this song. And the next thing you know, the project is dragging on and on and on. So that's one of the problems with the flat project fee. The second way is you can charge a per song fee. So in other words, your rate is $100 a song, $200 a song, $500 a song, $1,000 a song, whatever it might be, $20 a song. This is a little bit better in that if someone decides to do two extra songs, then great, you're going to get paid for two extra songs. The one thing it doesn't cover, unless you do this in advance, unless you really specify this in advance, is it doesn't cover, once again, if someone says, I want to do two extra versions. I want to do a reggae version, and I want to do a speed metal version. And suddenly you find the song is going on and on and on. Or if, in fact, it contains a lot of extra overdubs that no one was expecting. And all of a sudden, the song that you thought was going to take a couple days is going to a couple weeks or a couple months, and you're still working on it. So that's kind of the downside of the per song fee structure. Now, the way around this, of course, is right up front. You say, okay, I'm going to work on this, and here's the parameters. I'm only going to work for this amount of time, and after that, you have to pay me extra. One of the big problems that we have in this business is we just take the first offer, and we never negotiate what might happen later. And of course, when you first start in the business, that's kind of normal, but later on, you get smart about it, and you say, okay, here's the parameters, just in case this happens and it goes longer than anybody expects. The third way that we can charge for our services is to charge an hourly rate. And this is the safest way to go. If you're getting paid an hourly rate, then every time you work and for as long as you work, you're getting paid. One of the downsides is, of course, you sometimes find that you're not going to work as much because the client is going to say, well, I don't want to pay that money, so I'm only going to keep this person for X amount of time during the day, X amount of time for the song, X amount of time during the project. So you might find it gets limited, but that's also a good thing because you only get paid for the time you put in. So this is the safest way to actually deal with the project. Number four is to get paid on spec. And of course, this is the way we all start. What does spec mean? To get paid on speculation that the project is going to make money later. So in other words, as soon as the project is signed, then you get some of the signing bonus, you get some of the advance, or it just comes out of someone's pocket. Either way, at a certain point, a certain trigger, you get paid. In theory, this sounds really good. The bad part is, though, don't rely on a handshake because you probably won't get paid if that's the case. Make sure it's on paper and make sure it's specified. If X happens, then I get paid. If Y happens, then I get paid. And that's the only way that you can be sure that you're going to get your due. Because if you just go on a handshake, you'll find that people forget the parameters and forget what was promised very, very quickly. So make sure that you have it on paper. And of course, the fifth way is a combination of any of those other four. So in other words, you might get a flat fee plus an hourly fee if it goes over a certain period. You might get a per song fee plus some extra, plus it might go into an hourly rate at a certain trigger point. There's all sorts of different ways to make this work. So make sure whatever you do, you get it in writing, and you also have those trigger points set down on paper. So if this happens, then you're going to get paid for it. If that happens, you're going to get paid for it. And that's the safest way to get paid for the work you do in the music business. My guest today is the noted and eclectic producer, Michael Beinhorn. I recorded this interview at NAMM, at Summer NAMM, and that was for lynda.com. It was a five-camera shoot that we did, and you can watch the video if you click on the link that's down below in the comments. If you're not familiar with lynda.com, it's a wonderful portal for learning just about any kind of software program or business or a number of different things. There are video courses that are just wonderful, very high quality. I have 17 courses on there, a combination of audio and social media. You might want to check out some of my audio courses. There's a mixing course, there's a recording course, there's a mastering course, among other things. There's a Mastered for iTunes course. So check them out. Also, down below the comments, there's a link for 7 full days of full access to all the courses that lynda.com has. So sit back and listen to a very interesting discussion with a very interesting man, Michael Beinhorn. Michael Beinhorn began his career as a keyboard player for the cutting-edge band Material. He's gone on to produce artists like Herbie Hancock, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Aerosmith, Ozzy Osbourne, Korn, and many more. In 1998, Michael also received a Grammy nomination for his work with Hole and Marilyn Manson. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Bobby.
This is very cool. I want to go back to the beginning. you were pretty much a kid when you got with material, right?
Yep.
How old were you?
I actually, this was concurrent with me leaving home. Like, I literally, I just walked out of my house one day with like a knapsack, literally a knapsack, it wasn't a backpack, with like a pot, a pan, a fork, a knife, and a spoon.
Well, you're prepared anyway, right?
Yeah, it's about as prepared as you're going to get. So I'm like 17 years old, like basically going from Queens, New York to Manhattan and braving all the terrors of the that urban landscape, which was, you know, I mean, New York in like the late 70s was a snake pit.
Yeah, that's,
you know, it was interesting, to put it mildly. And I'm very grateful to be alive right now.
How'd you get the gig? Here's what I read. You tell me if it's true. There was an ad in New York in the music paper or something that you answered, right?
No. But you're close.
Oh, okay.
My friend Fred Marr and I, we just pal around. We were into all sorts of weird, esoteric, progressive music, and we started seeing these flyers all over the, you know, East Village. You know, are you into these bands? And it was basically a laundry list of every kind of music that we loved back then. No one else seemed to know about. And we were like, wow. And we went to this place, which turned out to be a building on 24th Street that was rented by this guy, Giorgio Gomelsky. You know who this is?
Of course. Well, Giorgio, he was responsible for the Rolling Stones getting started.
Yes, he was, and he produced all the early Yardbirds records.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and you know, so he had this place, and I guess he'd found this bass player named Bill Laswell, or they found each other, and Giorgio basically installed him in the downstairs in the basement, and people, there was just sort of like a revolving door of people who came in. And it wasn't really like a open call. It was more of like a let's see what happens type thing. And I don't even know why or how we all clicked, but we did. And that's kind of how that got started.
And sometimes it just happens. You know, you start to play and you go, wait a second, there's something bigger here than just, you know, however many of you are there. You know?
Ideally, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't happen that often. So when it does, like, you have to hold that precious.
Yeah, and that was like the first time out, too. That was the first time I ever really got into playing with a bunch of guys.
So wow, no
felt
kidding.
Felt very fortunate. Yeah, well, I wasn't really like a keyboard player, per se. I mean, I'd taken some piano lessons, but I think my first love was really the synthesizer, as an instrument, you know, and the sound creating, processing possibilities.
Like what kind of synths?
Well, back then I didn't have a lot of money, so I had a little Micro Moog.
Oh, I had one too. Way back when, yeah.
What a great instrument that was. That was so much fun.
I wish I still had it.
yeah, me too. Yeah, it's great.
Oh, that's cool. So, okay, so you started to play with Bill and material. Did you do a lot of gigs?
I wouldn't say we did like a massive amount of gigs, but we gigged, you know, every like, I don't know, we'd go through long periods of not gigging, then we'd do like, you know, a series of like gigs in a few weeks or something like that. But it was all the, you know, the standard places that you would play in New York,
yeah,
Tier
sure.
3, Mud Club, CBGB's, Hurrah.
Yeah.
You know, those clubs back when they were really hopping. It was an amazing time.
So when did you get the idea that maybe you wouldn't do more than being in a band?
It didn't really occur quite that way. Like, what happened was that we were pretty much making our own records. You know, when material started recording, Gomelsky was there for one record. And, you know, he'd been producer on the Yardbirds, but I think the sum total of his production input on what we did was kind of walking out into the room saying, oh, fellows, it sounds great. You know, or bringing out some meatballs after we've done it. Or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, so... That, you know, we pretty much did everything ourselves. I don't think that we even had a concept of what record production was, per se. And then we did a record for Elektra Musician, which involved a whole bunch of other players, and we were sort of directing them. Then we did another record for Elektra Proper, and we had a bunch of other, like, R&B musicians and singers, and one of them, Nona Hendrix, had a solo deal, and she asked us to be her producers on this record. And we were kind of like, I was really confused. I was like, what does that mean? So I kind of thought, oh, if I'm producing, I guess I'm like controlling stuff, or like, you know, so I can like basically order people around, or is that what happens? I wasn't really sure about, you know, so I, yeah. Let's put it this way. My sense of protocol and my bedside manner was a little iffy back then, but, you know, I mean, I was like 20, so yeah. I didn't know what I was doing.
Well, that's pretty cool, though. I mean, you get to produce Nona Hendrix, who everybody knew who she was then, and she was on Elektra. That was cool.
Well, she was on RCA.
We were
on Elektra.
But even so, yeah, that's, you know, on your 20 years old, that's pretty cool.
It was amazing, yeah. And I mean, one of the most exciting things for me was that we got to work with Brian Eno at that point, you know.
I was going to bring that up, actually. Yeah, so tell me about Eno.
Well, you know, Bill had been, apparently lived on the same block with him and kept, like, every day, like, I think he'd wait for Eno to come out of his house. And he'd just, like, come up to him and say, you got any gigs? You know, just kind of, you know, pestered him. And fortunately, Bill was a good enough bassist, very good, to the extent where Eno finally said, okay, I think I got something for you, which was a record called My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. And Bill played on two or three songs on that.
Yeah.
It's great, obviously.
Yeah.
And out of that, I think Eno decided that he wanted to do something a little bit different. So he got this idea of making a pop band. And it was Eno, Bill, this guy Bob Quine, who played in the Voidoids with Richard Hell, and Fred, and it was the five of them. And obviously, like, Eno was like sort of a hero to me. So I'm like, I was just like mortified, like, how come I'm not doing this? And they are. And I was so sad.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
You know, and they'd go down to the into our studio and jam. And, you know, one day Eno comes up to me because I was there. I'd come there and just like paint and sit around and sulk. And he comes up to me and he's like, would you like to join us? And I was like, would I?
Yeah.
And it was like the happiest day of my life. So, you know, we did that. And then My Life in the Bush of Ghosts came out. And I remember coming to the studio and Eno sitting on the couch, surrounded by like NME, Melody Maker, all these British music papers, and he's just absolutely like crestfallen. And we're like, what's up? And he's like, he got like 2 and 3 stars off all these papers, you know, just kind of like, yeah, it's okay. This guy's obsession with like, you know, all this like weird other music, and he just lost it. Like, I think he went into a really bad depression. He said, I'm not making rock music anymore. I'm making ambient music from now on. So he let Fred and Quine go. And it was me, him, Bill, and he got this guy named Axel Gross, like a friend, a conceptual artist, musician from Berlin, I think. And we made some ambient stuff. And I think he just kind of went like this a little bit, and We worked on that for another few months, and then it just sort of all fell apart. Then he went off by himself, and eventually Ambient 4 came out, and that was the product of what we'd done.
I love the ambient stuff of that period.
Those records are amazing.
It's groundbreaking in a way.
Yeah, it really is. So
it was really good. Okay, so you went from there. How did you make it out to California?
By default, I don't know. You know, when we worked with Hancock, I came out here for the first time, and you know, and then I kept coming back here because I think that this was really the place to go if you want to record anything. I mean, when I really started working heavily, all the really legendary studios were done in New York. Like, they'd just been taken out.
Yeah.
That was really tragic. But you couldn't, with a few noteworthy exceptions, you couldn't really make rock records in New York anymore. Yeah. You know, there's still some really good studios, but they didn't have places like, you know, Henson or Conway or, you know, or Sunset or
record
East
plant.
West
yeah.
Record Plant. Yeah. You know, and, you know, so I kept having to come back here if I wanted to make records. And you know, then there are personal things that brought me out here, too.
How did the Herbie Hancock record come about?
Well, it's a funny story because Herbie was actually at the end of his contract with Columbia, and I think this was going to be his swan song. Basically, that was after this one, they were going to give Herbie the old boot.
Wow.
And and because all his records he'd gone in a downward trajectory with everything that he did, and he, you know, that was it.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted him off the label, and he had like a pittance to work with, and somehow this guy named Tony Milant he was working with convinced him to get together with us. And yeah, it was crazy. And
it's not a combination I would have expected. You know,
but back then people were doing all kinds of weird stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd kind of, you know, and the thing is when you're looking at an artist, I think people thought differently back then. There was a little bit more kind of like, what the heck?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, let's throw on, you're trying to sell music, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about gambling. It's all about risk. You're going to have to throw the dice at some point, or else what are you doing? You know, nowadays they would have hooked them up with Max Martin or something.
Yeah, you're right. It's very safe. You're right.
Yeah, but like, you know, they hooked them up with us because we were doing like weird stuff. And we'd actually done a bunch of hip hop records at that point too.
Okay.
You know, back around like 81.
Yeah.
And so I guess, you know, he needed to do something that would be a little bit off the wall if he was going to go out in any kind of blaze of glory.
Yeah, yeah.
Or something where people would at least go, where critics would go, okay, this is really, really some new groundbreaking stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So for Bill and I, it became a real kind of like high concept type thing. Like, this is the guy who made, you know, Chameleon and Watermelon Man and stuff. Like, he was one of the people who introduced electronics into jazz rock fusion. And what would he be doing right now if he'd assumed that continuum of that trajectory, and also had been exposed to hip hop?
Yeah.
You know, if he'd actually kind of remained, if he was like, oh, like obviously we're trying to project onto this person a personality that he didn't actually have, you know, so we're kind of, you know, there's that going on there as well. But I, you know, to me, that's one of the beautiful things about art.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that you can kind of create these crazy visions in your mind and come, you know, and kind of at the other end come out with a, wow, that's what that looks like. That's kind of cool. I like that, you know? So that's really what that project was about.
And then you got a big hit out of it. Huge hit.
And it was great because it wasn't what we were doing it for. It wasn't what we'd prepared for. We were just there in the moment trying to do something that would be pleasing for us, that would be interesting, and that was fun.
But isn't that the way the best stuff always happens? The best
music. Every time. Every time.
You know, and it's like, the key word, you're doing something that's cool for you.
Yep.
And I think where people get off is when they try to follow the trends, they try to follow the notes they're getting from the label or whatever. And really, it's like, you know, an artist has to please himself first.
It would be, you'd think logically anyway, that would be the way to go.
Yeah.
It has to be.
I want to go back a little bit. So you said you did a bunch of hip hop records, and that's when hip hop was really taking off, right? Just about that time?
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah. So you were in that world right from the beginning.
Well, you know, it was an interesting jump from being into all this like off the wall prog rock and experimental music but actually it wasn't, because actually I did a panel with this guy, Damon Elliott, like about like 5 or 6 years ago or something. And he kept referring to what he was doing as electronic music. And I was like, he's basically a hip hop R&B producer. And I was like, he's right. This is what it is. It is electronic music, what he does.
Yeah.
And if you assume that kind of typification, if you stamp that on what he does, and then you take, but isn't Karlheinz Stockhausen electronic music too?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, who's like recording oscillator noises and filters to like tape and cutting it up. But it is. There's an enormous kind of breadth of this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
and it covers so much. But like those, you know, I love those connections. And to me, when we kind of branched that into hip hop, that's sort of what I kind of took along. It was kind of like, yeah, I'm the same guy who, you know, who listens to this other weird stuff, but like the hip hop stuff makes a lot of sense to me.
How have you felt hip hop has influenced you, like on the projects that you do now?
Well, I mean, it kind of stopped after a while. But I liked the aggression of
the early hip hop.
Yeah, I liked how aggressive it was. And, you know, they're obviously using sampled, sometimes very badly sampled drum sounds. You know, I mean, there's basically back in the really old days, the DMX, that was about it for samples.
Yeah.
And, you know, it always had that little crunch.
Yeah.
And that's what we wound up using on Rocket. But that was, you know, that aggression really kind of fed into the more rock stuff that I worked on. And it really influenced it. And I kind of liked the idea of kind of cross-collateralizing the two, like bringing them back together. Not in sort of like that sort of rap, rock type framework, which is kind of really, it kind of addresses more surface issues and not so much like the intrinsic stuff. But I saw that like a similarity in terms of the aggression, and I wanted to get that aggression into rock records in a different way.
Well, what I find interesting about you is the fact that looking at your background and how you started, and then I think you've become known mostly for the rock records you've done, because that's where you've pretty much had a lot of big artists that you work with anyway.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like it's a straight path to get there.
No.
I'm right then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But why should it be?
Well, I guess that's true. But, you know, you'd figure that, okay, if you're doing these rock records, then you would have started out in a rock band and you would have had that as your basic history rather than, you know, coming from, you know, the prog rock and then through hip hop and that way.
I'm from, like, the music is music school, and great music is great music, and anything else is good or mediocre or terrible. And, like, I mean, I did a panel earlier today. You know, and they asked us, me and the other guys, like, what were our earliest memories of, like, music, of a record that really was life-changing. Everyone else is talking about Elvis and the Beatles and stuff like that. One guy said Perry Como, which was awesome.
Whoa.
You know, but the first record that I really remembered was Arturo Toscanini conducting the NBC Symphony Orchestra, you know, doing Beethoven's 9 symphonies and the chorale movement of like the 9th. You know, I mean, like, to me, if that can't stop you dead in your tracks and just make you go, oh, you know, then you don't have a soul.
Yeah. Well, then how did it work then that all of a sudden you started to do these rock acts and you started to do some big rock acts as well? How do you evolve into that?
People started to know me better.
Yeah.
it's interesting what a couple of really successful records will do for someone.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be the way it works. And I was really fortunate to get involved with bands like the Chili Peppers, you know, like Soul Asylum and Soundgarden.
Soundgarden, yeah.
You know, all of which were at cusps. Like a really, really important transitional stage in their career. Now, you know, I mean, it could be argued that it might not have been a transition under different circumstances, you know. So I made my job as the producer on those records to create the insurance that this would be a cusp and this would basically be the evolution of an artist from point A to point B. And that's how it worked in all those cases. But it was all about the intent in that case.
Okay, so going into it, you're thinking that way then?
Hell yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, if I don't know that people work this way so much now.
That's why I'm asking you, because it doesn't seem the norm.
Well, My thing is, if you're going to do something, you may as well do it like full bore and not half-ass.
Yeah.
Kind of makes sense. But
You're projecting farther out than the most people are thinking, well, song by song, or maybe the whole record, but they're not thinking kind of beyond that, which
I can't relate to that, you know. And it's because when I get a bunch of songs, I am seeing individual pieces that also make up a unified body of work. Mm. Now, as more songs get are contributed to that, the unified body of work starts to come more into focus. So you can kind of see what that's going to be. So when I start a record, there's always a mental image of what that's going to turn into. Now, that being said, what the end product is generally bears no resemblance to what I saw at the beginning. Mm. But I think that's a very important distinction to make, because like the beginning, because that starting point, that place where you see where you get the mental image of what this thing's going to turn into, should be what you're focusing on. And you should be, and like, you know, just being the producer of the project, it's imperative to be prepared to turn on a dime to, you know, deal with whatever changes come your way.
Yeah.
And that's part of the gig.
You like to fire drummers, right? You know what? That was coming. Let me back up on that. Just for the people that are watching this. I did a Google search of Michael Beinhorn a couple of days ago, and this topic keeps on coming up. I mean, that's in the first page and the second page and the third page. Michael Beinhorn likes to fire drummers. And I've read what you said about that, and I think it's brilliant and it's absolutely true. But
well,
anyway, can explain it, please, for the people that are watching this.
Well, I mean, I think that you're referring to one specific instance in particular, because I think that's where a lot of this came from.
Yeah.
I had developed a reputation doing that, which was really funny because so many of my contemporaries did the same thing. And it just didn't really occur to me that that was too far outside the norm. In fact, a lot of records that I knew of, like, it was sort of commonplace to just look at the drummer and say, you're out.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I didn't feel like I should, you know, that was a good idea, because at least you want to give the person a chance. But anyway, on the project in particular, which was Celebrity Skin, the whole record, without getting too far into the particulars of it, it was, it was a very, I think it was a very fair attempt on everyone's part to let Patty do her stuff. One thing that was never addressed when she presented her side of the thing was the fact that she also got like a month and a half of solid pre-production before the record, that I worked with her very closely to ensure, like, we worked on all her drum parts, and I would just stand there and, like, work with her through her, through practice and whatnot. And, you know, she'd occasionally get the song straight through. Sometimes she'd mess up, and I'd just be there as a cheering squad.
Yeah.
You know, because I could tell that she was extremely sensitive, and I wanted to make sure that she got the kind of support that she needed. When we started the record, one thing that the band said to me, and this was like a prerequisite before going in, you can do this record, but on one condition, you cannot fire the drummer.
Oh, really?
Yep. That's right. That was the prerequisite for the record. And I was like, all right.
Wow.
That's what you want, then that's what we're going to deal with. And, you know, based on that, I was like, the only way this is going to work is if I'm able to work with Patty, like, 5 days a week, not seven, because we don't want to wear her out or anything like that. Let's just, you know, but like, just be consistent. And like a month and a half of that, and I actually thought that we were at a place with her where she was really on it. And the minute she came into the studio, she got a case of what we all know as red light fever.
Yeah.
And I think there were a couple of other things that were in the mix as well. But, you know, I think she was very unnerved by the situation, and everything that we had gone over just went out the window. You know, we worked very hard on drum parts, and where to put fills, and she started forgetting the songs and things like that. And we started going through it over and over again, and I stuck with it for about 2.5 weeks, and it just wasn't, it kind of plateaued. It wasn't getting better or worse, but it was at a point where a band like this, you can't possibly make a record with drum tracks that sound like these. So I talked to the band about it. I was like, look, we have a serious problem. And they were like, ain't gonna happen. Remember what we talked about? And I was like, okay. Then about a week later, Courtney came into the studio and heard one of the drum tracks and things changed. And but they didn't want to get involved in the whole process of saying bye-bye.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They said, well, since you brought it up, you have to do it. So I, you know, because we got to work with her. So I had to become the, you know, the point man on that.
Of course, yeah.
And that's, you know, that's part of what happens.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as far as being hard on drummers, as far as pushing them, you know, the drums are the foundational part of a rock record, of just about any type of pop music. And if you're going to do a recording where, you know, where you're purposely going out of your way to spare someone the kind of, you know, having to really sort of force or push through stuff, because I'm sure you've seen this, you know, in a recording sometimes people have like psychological breakthroughs.
No kidding. Yeah.
Like they'll either break down or fall apart and then like build themselves back up. I saw a guy I was convinced wasn't going to cut it on a record, you know, and I was like on his ass too. He got up and he was like, all right, I just need to get some air. And he came back in, all like the nerves were gone. He sat down and he just tore it up. Yeah. And I was like, I kissed him after that. I was like, I've seen so few people come through that. That's what this is. It's a rite of passage. And it's imperative that people who do this are willing to accept it and are willing to take responsibility for themselves and not hold other people out for blame, you know, for things that that's ultimately their responsibility. If you put yourself out as I'm the drummer on this record and you can't drum, you shouldn't be on it.
Yeah,
if I put myself out and say I'm the producer on this record and I represent myself that way, and then I come in, I'm sitting around, and every time someone asks me something, I go, I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I shouldn't be producing.
Yeah.
It's, you know, same thing.
Do you, when you're doing drum tracks, how much do you fix a track?
It varies. It varies a lot. You know, some drummers just are extraordinary. It's really, you know, I mean, sometimes timing can be a factor with people. But I prefer feel over timing. Like, I'd rather err on the side of feel because that's really what makes a piece of music interesting.
So
it's the feel of it. Well, it depends. Like, I've had to lately because I find that more people they sort of swerve a little too much. And I noticed that it really kind of, that in the case of some bands, especially when they've gotten used to playing with a click and then you take it away, the swerve is really, it's not like a Led Zeppelin record anymore. It's kind of like, wow, I really felt that sag right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if you listen to a Led Zeppelin record, his timing, please, you know, put a click up against that and tell me that's solid. That's as unsolid as it gets, but his feel never, ever, ever deviates for a split second. And that's what, it's hypnotic.
There's something online I saw, it was on Charlie Watts doing Sympathy for the Devil, and it starts out like at 110 and it ends up at 138 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But no one has ever complained about that ever because it just feels so great. It smokes, it, you know.
He's a badass.
Yeah, yeah, right.
These guys are badasses, you know, like when you have people that play that way and are also able to project themselves through their instrument, as opposed to in the case of a drummer, someone who's like hitting things in time so everyone else will play in time with them, you're more inclined to get the personality of the player, which is far more important than like noticing whether or not this thing I'm listening to is in time.
Yeah. Have you found that because we live in a day and age where music is pretty much on the beat, everything is quantized, and you know, with EDM especially, you can feel it. Everything is very precise. Do you feel, as a producer, that you have to conform to that somehow?
No.
Because that's what people expect to hear. All right.
I actually enjoy syncing synthesizers up to people performing when it's appropriate, but if you're going to tighten things up, tighten them up. You know, I'm going to back up. Everyone should make records exactly the way they see fit. It's not for me to say how a record gets made. I can only speak to my own process. Mm-hmm. In my case, I want to hear stuff as loose, the ultimate kind of balance between loose and tight, depending on what it is, the context that it's within is super important in that case. And, you know, as far as like tightening a rock record up to, you know, being to EDM tight, it's not for me.
Yeah.
You know, I love synthesizers. I enjoy certain kinds of dance music and stuff, but like, it's kind of like, if you've got people playing live, why do this?
Have you done any EDM or anything like that?
Not recently. I mean, anything that I've done that could be called EDM was many, many years ago.
Okay, yeah. Because I'm just wondering how you'd approach it, considering your philosophy, how you'd approach that, since it's mostly in the box.
Well, fortunately, Reason, you can get stuff in analog, so, you know.
Yeah, okay.
If you can sync stuff up that way. Although I haven't really enjoyed, like, the combination of digital and analog synthesizers together. I don't really like the way they sound. I mean, I kind of feel like it should be one or the other. Mm-hmm. That's the way I see it. Like, there's just digital stuff pokes out so much.
Yeah.
But it misses some of the nice harmonic richness of the analog stuff. And the analog stuff doesn't have the same kind of transient. You know, it's two things that, like, I think maybe it's me. Maybe I'd have to work harder to get them to fuse better.
But you know what? Now that you mention it, I never thought about that, but I think you're right. The combination somehow seems to fight.
That's my feeling.
When you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, like, when you listen to an old Depeche Mode record, for example, I mean, that's basic, that's all pretty quantized.
Yeah.
But it's all analog synths.
Yeah.
And they've got that nice, that richness.
Yeah.
You know, and going back even further, a band like Kraftwerk, like, there's very little sequencing on those records at all. They're pretty much all played live.
Yeah.
And you can feel it.
Yeah.
It's got a really nice groove to it.
Yeah, it's so funny how we love those records, and we love the feel of them, and yet we don't make them so often these days.
Nope. And talk about groundbreaking. I mean, you know, without Computer World, for example, there'd be so many genres of music would either not exist right now, or they'd be so completely different.
Yeah.
Just because of boom, pop, boom, pop, boom, pop, boom, boom, yeah. boom. You know?
Yeah. So what do you think about music today?
Well, it depends what you mean.
That's a wide open door. I know.
Yeah.
So depending on who you speak with, there are some people that will say it's more vital than ever before. I know there are others that will say, I don't know. It's doesn't seem to have that spark. Where do you fall?
I think that, first of all, there are a lot of really, really talented creative people in the world. I do feel that creative potential is a resource that's grossly, grossly underused at this point in time. I mean, in many different fields of endeavor, but in the arts, in the popular arts, I don't think anywhere more than there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a serious deficiency in the brain trust that feeds the periphery of the popular arts.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that there is an element of daring and an element of risk and an element of wanting to aspire to the highest possible level that you are capable of as a human being that is non-existent right now in popular art, popular music. And I feel that that is one of the essential aspects of what it is.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, that's also a very broad question, because
yeah.
I feel that there are a lot of societal issues. I think that there is one element, which I started referring to as the homogenization of things, that within certain categories,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are groups of commodities, items that are manufactured by, you know, there's competition. And over time, the product of all those competitors has gone like this, that it's sort of converging on one point and it's becoming very samey. Now in music, the way that presents itself is that we, you know, back in the 60s, say even before, like when you thought of music, you thought of a name of a person you liked. You didn't think of like what style of music they did. You're just like, I'm into Elvis, I'm into this one, you know, I'm into whatever. It was the artist, because the artist is what propels the medium. Now, you're less inclined when you think of music to think of the artist, but the genre that they perform in.
We're in a singles world, though. Could that be part of it?
That's what people say. But I feel that that's a case of the tail wagging the dog.
Oh, how so?
Because I think that if people are unwilling to make records that have more than one good song that's worth listening to, you're not going to be able to sell more than one song.
Well, that's true. Many people feel that the album kind of has run its course. And I think one of the reasons for that, honestly, is albums are too long. When CDs came out, because you had 74 plus minutes, people felt like they had to fill it up. And yet when I go back and I look at all the best albums, they were 35, 38, 40 minutes, that's it. So basically what you put on was pretty good because you only did 6 or 7 or 8 songs. You didn't feel like you had to do 10.
But we're still talking about the same format, you know?
Yeah.
If we apply your logic to the situation, we're still talking about a record that's got a bunch of songs on it. It's just less songs.
That's true. But the hope would be that at least you'd have better songs.
Yeah, but that has yet to happen.
But okay, but let me ask you this, though. I mean, you can go down and look at charts down through history, and you can find song after song after song that nobody thought would ever be a hit, and yet they were. So it's really hard to say when you look at 10, however many songs you have on an album, which are the ones that are really going to tickle the fancy of the public. It's hard to tell that.
Depends who you are, and it depends what you're talking about. You know, I've worked on records where I think almost every record I've worked on, I knew what the lead songs were going to be. It was just very apparent. Like, in some cases, glaringly obvious.
Yeah.
You know, look, someone drops a song in your lap like Runaway Train by Soul Asylum. What are you going to say?
Yeah, right, right.
You know, or Black Hole Sun.
Right, okay.
I heard that and I was like, huh. You know, but why don't people write songs that good anymore? This is my question. I mean, it's a rhetorical one. You don't need to respond. But like, you know, my feeling is that there are so many elements that feed into this. And like we were talking before, one of those elements happens to be the absolute patent disregard that people in record companies have for artist development.
Why do you think that is?
I can tell you why that is. It's because the issues are mainly financial. And it also pertains to turnover. What the record companies are trying to do now is they're trying to hedge their bets as much as possible and have as much turnover as they can have. They're trying to flood the market with as much product. Hopefully something will stick. But that mentality never works. You can throw a bunch of shit against the wall, it's going to fall off pretty fast.
But Michael, hasn't that always been the case where there's been a 10 to 1 or greater ratio? I mean,
10 to 1.
10 to 1. 10, you know, 10 records to one hit.
Try 1,000 records.
Or whatever it is.
Because that's what we got now. You know, the degree of interest that people have in music has changed drastically. I'm going to take you back in time.
Okay.
Why don't you come with me into the Wayback Machine
Please take me for a moment?
Okay. Perhaps you remember a time 15, 16 years ago, when people started complaining about the music that they were listening to. That if you bought a CD, when you paid 18 to 20 bucks for your CD, because that's how much the record companies were charging, you'd get one good song and about 11 crap ones. And this was happening across the board. And I remember this specifically, artists who had reputations for putting out great, great records were starting to put out the worst, most insipid, boring records of their entire careers. And they weren't really selling the way they used to. And things started to get a little bit hairy. You know, actually, the record sales only went down in as much as the public weren't pleased with the output of the artist.
Yeah, yeah.
But they couldn't do anything about it because they had no other way to kind of like deal with this.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you want the song, you have to buy it. It's that simple. And they weren't, the record companies weren't making like CD singles available as much. So if you wanted this one awful song, you had to plunk down a lot of money.
Yeah.
And people were getting really pissed off.
Yeah.
And that's around the time that file sharing started happening. And it was a game changer. I'm not saying that it's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. But it's something that I feel, based on technology, would have had to happen one way or another.
Do you think this was happening because artists were dogging it, for want of a better term?
I think everyone was getting lazy. You know, we were getting fat because everyone was making lots and lots of money doing this. It was a really fat time. It was great. You know, if I wanted to get like, you know, $1 million budget for a record, I had it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people didn't look at that stuff like askance. You know, I mean, I did one record where like the budget was, I mean, I had almost, well, relative to the artist, it was almost nothing. But nowadays it would have been a king's ransom.
Yeah.
You know, we went off to record. We'd spent a long time assembling material. We went off to record at a studio in Paris. So he went through the budget in like a month, like everything he had left. You know, so I brought the chairman of the record company came down to listen to the tracks. I played him a bunch of stuff. He turned red. He was trying not to smile. And he said, you can have whatever you want. You know, that's how it was done back then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, he knew he was going to be okay. And he was.
Yeah.
There is an emotional disconnect, I think, that happens in most music that's being made now. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I find that a lot of people I talk to who are not in music, involved in music creation or involved in the business in any way, shape, or form, because I would rather get their side of things because they got to deal with this. You know, they can choose to listen to it or not.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to know what they think. And I get this from people through every age group, every walk of life. I don't connect.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing, like, I've heard people say this, like, I don't get the feeling from it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's nothing that's emotionally, like, there's nothing that, like, I don't get a sensation.
Yeah.
Music is visceral. It's all about communicating an idea through sound vibrations that makes your body feel a certain way.
Yeah.
It's got very little to do with whether or not you can sing along with a melody. I mean, sure, that's wonderful. But it's the feeling that it left you with. That's what you're going back to.
Well, why did that happen?
I think that we all started to slack. I really do. I think the business started to slack. I think that they started to believe that they'd actually systematically developed a technique to be able to print money, because that's what we were doing.
You know what my theory is?
What?
In 1982, the first drinking and driving laws were passed.
I have a friend who thinks the same, who says the same thing that you do.
And what ended up happening was the clubs started to go away, and as a result, the farm team died.
Do you know Fletcher?
Yeah, of course I do.
Okay, because he says the same exact thing. It's really funny. I think that, you know, I think that that's a factor in it, you know. But I also feel that there are a lot of other things, you know, that people in this society have become very, very, this isn't going to sound very nice, but people are very entitled. You know, they think that they really deserve to get stuff because they've been told how wonderful they are.
Mm.
You know, and it's like,
that's a generational thing,
it's
really.
It's a generational thing, but it doesn't work if you're trying to make great art. It can't work.
Yeah.
There's no way. There's also a lot of other elements, like the democratization of music. You know, the fact that
people... The gatekeepers are gone. Yeah.
The gatekeepers are gone, but also the software exists so that anyone can have the illusion in their mind that they can make a song or make a record.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. You have what... you ever hear of a guy named Jean Baudrillard?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He referred to this as simulacra. That you can, you know that?
Yeah.
You know, it's basically the all the surface elements or certain identifying elements of a thing, but lacking the core elements, like the intrinsic elements of what it really is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you haven't created an identical,
not an understanding,
a replica.
Yeah.
You've created a simulacra of something that is missing a lot of really key elements.
Yeah.
And that's what music is turning into now.
You know, I just want to mention that you have one of the best blogs.
Thank you.
And what it is, it's for the deep thinker in music, because it's one of those things where it goes beyond where most blogs will go. And believe me, as someone who writes blogs a lot, you get deep into things, which is wonderful. And also, let's get your book.
All right.
Because speaking of which, you're going in the same direction. You're taking record production and you're pulling back the layers on it,
so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Yeah. I think that people have a tremendous misunderstanding about what record production really is. At least a lot of core elements about it. And it had occurred to me that no one had really kind of laid out the more kind of esoteric mm-hmm. aspects of it. You know, the methodology that one might use, the thought process that one might take to go into taking apart a piece of music. You know, being able to analyze stuff so that you can be of assistance to an artist.
But that's every great record producer that I know has always been able to do that, has been able to go in and say, wait a second, this is working, this isn't working, right?
Absolutely.
You're right, that's something that isn't written about.
It's not written about, and also the interpersonal aspects, you know, of dealing with people, you know, working with people one-on-one or in a small creative group.
Yeah. What's your method when you're starting a project? What's the first thing you do?
Just immerse myself in the artist's work. I feel like I have to make it a part of me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's two really important points for me in that in the listening process. Because to me, the listening process is absolutely vital for me to do my job.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the very first time that I listen to a piece of music. And the second one is when I feel that I have gained a profound, innate understanding of what that is,
or what they're trying, where they're trying to go with it.
Not something that you can necessarily describe, that you can specifically describe, but just like I have a sense of it.
Yes,
like
right.
Because it's become a part of me because I understand it now.
Right.
It's something that you can't describe to people.
Yeah,
it's
really visceral. Yeah.
But if someone asks you a question about it, it's like you know the answer away because you feel it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You feel it. And that's actually what I was trying to say before that I kind of lost my train of thought.
Yeah.
That there are also, being creative, there are also like visceral elements to the process. When you actually enjoy something that you listen to, you feel it in your body.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
right.
Something that we don't talk about in the work that we do. You know, likewise, if you hear something that you don't like, it affects you physically too. It makes you feel like you're being hurt. Like I can feel it feels like my skin's on fire when I hear something that I don't like.
Yeah.
The other day I was at the shopping mall with my wife and I was just, all of a sudden it occurred to me that I heard like four songs in a row with like hard auto-tuned vocals. And I was like, if I hear one more of these, there's gonna be murders around here. This is really bad, you know?
But you know, there's that whole theory that, and I think it's more than a theory actually, that digital audio and auto-tune and the fact that things are being manipulated digitally go against your analog nervous system.
Who am I to argue?
And as a matter of fact, I remember way back This is when the AES show was at the Waldorf Astoria, which goes back into the 70s.
Oh, wow, I remember
in
that.
In New York, yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember the first digital machine that was out, and there were one crowd of people saying, this is the best thing that ever happened, this is great. And you had another crowd that was saying, no, this is evil. And there was one particular professor that wrote a paper saying, this is not only evil, this is something that can actually physically hurt you. And I remember there the first AES show that everybody was up in arms. You were either on one side or the other about this.
Yeah, I remember that too.
Yeah, yeah. And here we are now, all these many years ago, and now we're in a digital world.
Oh, I remember when the running joke was like, yeah, Pro Tools is great if you're trying to make a pop record, but no one is ever going to make a rock record
on one of those. Yeah, right. when it comes to Pro Tools, how much do you actually get in and tweak stuff?
You mean like edit things?
Yeah. During a project?
As much as it needs. That's pretty subjective, but like, you know.
Are you opposed to going in and really fine-tuning things?
Not if it's appropriate to the music, but I kind of like to err on the side of like not too much. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, that said, I just did a record where it was, you know, we actually wound up doing a lot of editing. And the vocalist actually wanted, and it was appropriate for some of the songs for him to put auto-tune on his voice. Oh. And I was like, you know, and I sat there and I was like, well, I mean, it actually kind of works on this, you know, these particular songs. Yeah. So I don't think it's wise to stand on ceremony when it comes to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm kind of contradicting myself
a little bit. Let's get a little esoteric on this here now. Where do you come down on vocal breaths, editing them out or not, or letting them stay?
Really? You want to know what I think about that?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I do.
I love vocal breaths.
Okay.
I love a full performance. I like to, you know, like I've had people pull them all out and I've been like, no, please.
Yeah, yeah, I know that.
Please. I mean, it makes me feel like I have an intimate connection with this person, which is what I want. You know, like I want to feel something when I listen to a piece of music. I want to feel that they're kind of like at me.
Yeah.
Like addressing me directly. And the breath is like, you know, you can't remove the physical attributes of a person too much from a performance, because then you basically don't have a person there anymore.
How do you approach vocals? In other words, do you prepare the studio in a certain way for the vocalist?
It really depends on the singer. Like a lot of people need a lot of different things. You know, I worked on, as far as like environment, some people feel really uncomfortable with a bunch of people in the room. Some people want a bunch of people in the room. Some people can work well with only certain people. And then I have to figure out who those people are and leave them there. You know, I mean, I did one record where it occurred to me that the singer was only comfortable with one person, and he didn't even realize it.
Mm, yeah.
So I saw the way they interacted, and I was like, okay, you're going to run the vocal session, me and the engineer leaving, and that's how we got all our vocals.
Wow.
And when I work with Soundgarden, one of the first things I noticed from Chris is that he hates singing around people. He just absolutely despises it. So what I did was, since he was so good at, he made great demos on his own at home, so we just hooked him up in the studio. We put him in front of the console, gave him his tracks, gave him the tracks on the tape machine to arm, set a vocal mic up, ran it out of phase with the loudspeakers, and just said, 6 to 8 passes, come and get me when you're done.
You just comped everything then?
I just comped everything when he was finished, and I think that's how he records his vocals now.
But you know what? Not many producers would do that. Not many producers would leave the room.
Well,
I'm saying that's terrific that you would be so cognizant of the situation of the vocalist in order to get the best out of him and feel comfortable of leaving.
But my function in that case isn't about dominance. You know, my function isn't about control at that point. My performance is being a conduit and allowing and creating fluidity so that the performer can do their best work.
Yeah.
You know, instead of micromanaging every single thing that he does, which in some cases is applicable.
Where do you think the music business is going?
Well, the music industry, as far as record labels, I am very positive that if they are unwilling to heed the future, they're going to continue to shrink. I think that's unavoidable.
You think they're shrinking now?
Isn't it weird? It's hard to believe. Oh, you're not joking.
I'm not joking. No, I don't believe they're shrinking. Right.
In terms of revenue?
Well,
$40 billion 10 years ago to $16 billion?
It's not as bad as you would think. It's not as bad.
They're attempting to diversify.
Yeah, they're very good at that.
Well, they're as good as they can be. But they have still lost, they've lost sight. And I'm sorry to interrupt
you. Yeah, go ahead.
But I feel that they've lost sight of the core issue of what made record companies necessary in the first place.
Yeah.
And that's music. They have lost sight of that completely. And if an industry, an entire industry, is predicated on the basis of subsidizing an art form, that's why they exist, because there was music before there was a music industry, right? And people were making pretty good music, as we can recall. You know, so it just came in there to kind of commoditize it a bit more. But now the business has superseded the music. Before, it was always art first. Even when you were talking about people who were trying to create commercial music, quote unquote, there was always an emotional component. That's not there anymore. If they keep insisting on doing that and constantly homogenizing their product and causing it to converge like this.
But Michael hasn't been there for 35 years.
The music industry?
Well, we're agreeing on the same thing. I think we're not agreeing on the timeline, though.
Oh, okay.
I've always felt that the music industry was at its peak when the owners of the record labels were fans. It was very small. And you go back and you look at Ahmet Erdogan.
Those were the days.
Right. And you had music entrepreneurs. They loved their artists and they loved the music that happened. They were their fans. And in 1980, it all changed. It changed because CDs came in. All of a sudden, there was a cash cow. Music industry was a cash cow. And five of the six major record labels were taken over by conglomerates.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, now what we had was suits and ties and accountants and attorneys that were running the show.
I couldn't agree with you more on this.
And it's been progressively downhill ever since. It's never gotten better. But really, I look forward to small little indie record labels where, again, it's run by a fan that are going to become tomorrow's major label.
I think that sounds really good, you know, and I'm behind that. But the thing is that there has to be a springboard for this too.
Yeah.
Right now, what we're seeing is a tapering off. And that's what I was talking about before. The fact that like people's enthusiasm, people who listen, their enthusiasm is tapering off.
Yeah.
You have to create a bridge between the listeners and the people who are making the music in order to reestablish some kind of that type of continuum where you can create fans, where you can create people who, again, are so inspired by the music that they hear that they want to do anything, that they're just driven. Yeah. And that's the difference. Because now music is kind of like an either or, like I can take it or leave it type condition. Whereas before, and I know you remember this, you couldn't leave it.
Yeah, oh,
you
absolutely.
Couldn't leave it. It was obsessive. It was something that took hold of your very soul.
Could it be because there hasn't been a big trend in a while and a new trend in music would actually do that?
I don't know if it's, I don't, well, you know, it's interesting because like, one thing that I've noticed along with what you're talking about is the absence of, like corollary kind of like folk music forms that run concurrent with the popular music because, you know, rock music basically started from blues.
Yeah,
Any classical music that you can refer to or even popular song of the, you know, of the day, all based around folk themes.
Yes.
A lot of it is. Like they could take from that.
Yeah.
We haven't had a folk music form that has fed popular music forms since the blues. You know, I mean, with hip hop, it's a little different. Like, I personally, I feel like Jamaican dancehall music is kind of like it's more homegrown.
Yeah.
That's really what's informed a lot of hip hop music for the last like 10 years. And I was really, really excited about how that was, you know, how that was changing hip hop.
Yeah.
You know, because it brought in a lot of new sounds, a lot of obviously new beats and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, just in terms of like rock music, we have nothing that's really informing that. So we're really kind of like, we're kind of hitting a standstill. And that's why I think people need to become more vigilant, more aware of what's happening, what the ramifications already are, not what they could be, because we're seeing the result of this now, you know?
Whose responsibility is that?
It's everybody's. Everyone who's involved in music has a responsibility. And part of it comes from just insisting on the absolute best that you can do.
But best is relative.
Is it? You know?
Well, yeah. What I think is just, you know, the best thing since sliced bread. You may not
agree. No, but I'm talking about the best that you can do. I'm not analyzing what you're doing.
You're not talking about taste.
I'm talking about personal responsibility.
I got it, yeah.
If you wake up and you're an artist, let's say, or involved in, you know, in the periphery of art creation.
Yeah.
And you wake up and go, am I doing enough? You know, am I focusing on the right things?
Yeah.
Have I put my emotion, my passion, everything that I feel?
Yeah.
You know, am I missing something?
Yeah.
Am I avoiding something emotional?
Yeah.
Is there something like emotional in my life that I'll turn away from instead of accepting and let it really kind of bring me down?
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I do that, I might be upset, but it also might expose me to something new that I can apply to what I do.
Yeah.
Creatively, because that's what art has been, you know, when people became cognizant of art as an aesthetic necessity.
In
a culture.
There's a lot of people that want to be in the music business today. There's schools everywhere. Every college has a program for recording, for you name it. But there's only so many spots in the music business.
Yep.
What do you tell those people?
Well, I think that basically the only way to do anything in this business at all is to get like extraordinarily good at what it is that you do, just to be incredible.
Yeah.
It's as silly as that might sound, but it's the truth. Be absolutely incredible. Be prepared to be the best that you can. Be also to be a good person. Be someone that other people can rely upon. You know, and someone who's ready to be a team player. You know, someone used like the Kobe Bryant versus Magic Johnson analogy recently. I mean, Magic Johnson was like one of the best players, not because he was, you know, a star off on his own, but because he knew who to pass to to get the point. You know, whereas Kobe's was always like taking the shot on his own. You know, I mean, he's a spectacular basketball player. But, you know, it's imperative to be a team player, but to excel at the same time.
Yeah.
And, well, there's really so much that you can say to answer that question. You know, when you're prepared to excel, you also can't let anything stop you. You just can't be, you can't permit anything to slow you down whatsoever. And it's imperative not to listen to what other people say, especially, particularly if it's critical, but to look for critique constantly, but also consciously assess everyone and anyone who has a comment. And, you know, check them for an agenda, make sure that they're not talking to you because they want to like fill your head with something. Like, take everything that's relevant, even the stuff that like hurts you, and apply it, and toss everything else out. You know, to be discerning, and to be as expressive as possible too. Like, you know, this may sound weird, but like to go into life like a gaping wound, like an exposed nerve that's ready for anything. You know, but isn't bracing against the shock of something bad. Be prepared, because that's what life is about. It's not going to last very long.
That's a great analogy.
You know?
Yeah, this has been terrific. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Bobby. Pleasure.
To find out more about Michael, go to michaelbeinhorn.com. That's Michael Beinhorn, all one word, Beinhorn.com. Michael Beinhorn. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he's the guy that actually puts this show together. Thank you very much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com or at bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.